Hello and welcome to the Sorbet Mesa podcast. I'm your host, Alan Maguire. I hope you're all well, getting ready for Christmas. We've had our Spotify Wrapped out this week. Our biggest episode was Spanish election too close to call. And the most shared episode was on Pontevedra. So get out there and share a few more episodes, please. With me this week, I have Aaron Shulman, who is the author of The Age of Disenchantment, the epic story of Spain's most notorious literary family and the long shadow of the Spanish Civil War. So welcome to the Sobremesa podcast, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Aaron, I'm reading this, but I'm really enjoying it. It's a bit like so much stuff about culture of Spain in there around this dark time when, you know, often people concentrate on the war, you know, the figures of the military and politics. So I'm really enjoying it's a completely different view, and also the fact that it's sort of you know, centered around a family that are normal people, but at the same time they're very unique. So can you tell me, how did you end up writing a book about Franco's favorite poet?
Let's see. So I'm married to a Spaniard. My wife's from Cordoba, and back in 2012, we were living in Madrid, and we'd lived in Cordoba previously, and I had a group of friends there. And then one of my friends from there, Javi, had moved to Madrid. So we're in Madrid at the same time. Javi's a judge, but his real secret life is he's like the most obsessive cinephile I know. And you know, and I'm fairly into film too. And so there was one day, just he was like, "Hey, why don't you come over to my house?" Of course, he's got a projector. He's like, "Why don't you and Elisa come over? I have this film. It's kind of a cult classic from the 70s. I think you'll be into it." And I was like, "Okay, sure." And we go over, and it's a documentary called El Desencanto, which, you know, watching El Desencanto that night sort of, in my book, I describe it is a big bang of sorts in my life that then sent me, you know, that really ended up consuming the next several years of my life. So we watched El Desencanto, which on the surface is a very idiosyncratic documentary directed by Jaime Chavarri and about a family who the Panero family, the father was Leopoldo Panero, who isn't present in the film because he had died. And so it's his three sons and his widow ostensibly talking about him and the history of the family. But it just goes to some bizarre places, especially when you put it in the context of Spain. It was filmed in 1974 and 1975 and then came out in 1976. So a very either opportune or inopportune moment with right after Franco died.
It was the last film, right, to be managed by the state, yeah. Censorship, is that right?
Yeah, so one of the sons, Leopoldo Maria, says something along the lines of, "En el manicomio de no sé dónde me chupaban los subnormales por un paquete de tabaco." And so that, obviously, the censors didn't take kindly to that. So the director of the film, Jaime, told me he thought that was the last, since the film came out in 1976, that was the last instance of censorship by the regime.
Wow.
So I watched the film and then learned more about it, that it wasn't just seen as a, you know, a quirky family. When it came out, it got, in 1976, it became read as a sort of metaphor because the widow and the sons, they sort of excoriate the father, and that was read as a metaphor of sorts. And so, it, you know, right after Franco died, and the father of the nation is being, you know, reassessed in certain ways, and they're looking at what Franco's legacy is, and then they see this family on the microcosmic level looking at what the legacy of their father figure is. And it's funny because the Vanetos always said, "Oh, we held back in the documentary." And friends of theirs, I think it was Javier Marías, when I interviewed him, said, "Oh, the El Desencanto was kind of like the the light version of an evening with the Paneros. It wasn't
really
raw. Yeah, it wasn't even as raw as it often got there. So I think of the way, to use a word from today, the film sort of went viral in 1976 for how could go viral in that day. And now when you look at the history of La Transición and most histories that talk about the culture always see that desencanto as a big part of the transition, as Spain was shifting from, shifting in so many ways from the dictatorship to what was to come in the future.
It's a really interesting metaphor though, right? I mean, exorcism of some sort of father figure. But I mean, Leopoldo Panero isn't just a poet, a Spanish poet. He was a very fascinating patriarchal figure in himself. Can you tell us a bit about his, why did this documentary become like a cult classic and become so notorious on its release? What was his figure? What was it about his figure that made it so enchanting? Bearing in mind, he's not even in the film.
Right. There's just the film opens and closes with the statue of him before it's unveiled in his hometown. It's wrapped in this plastic tarp, and it's this very symbolic image of it's like the father figure is gagged, beginning and end, and then the family just says whatever they want about him. So Leopoldo Panero was he's a fascinating figure, and he was really hard to figure out, even having access to letters that he wrote from his teenage years all the way through the last years of his life. And lots of people wrote memoirs that touched on him, and he was just cryptic in some ways. So before the Spanish Civil War, he was part of this group in Madrid where you had all these incredible poets, Alexandre, Lorca, Neruda, just this really incredible cultural renaissance in the first half of the 30s. And Neruda was a kind of mentor for him, Alexandre. This whole tight-knit group of brilliant poets who all either, scattered, were killed, or found some way to remain in the country, like Alexandre. And that whole group was very left-leaning, and Leopoldo Panero considered himself a communist. He went around with the hammer and sickle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on his jacket. But that was sort of like the trend at the time. It was sort of like the los señoritos, the rich educated young men were all poetic men were all, most of them were communists. Although what's interesting, I don't think we see this today. Today we sort of see literariness associated with the left in a sort of almost predetermined set of politics. But at that time, there were conservative poets, and so that there wasn't necessarily a tradition that was so clearly divided.
Right.
And so then the war breaks out. Leopoldo is from from Astorga, a town in León, and he's caught in the nationalist side of the war at the start. He's taken to prison, almost executed, gets out of jail because his mother is a distant cousin of Franco's wife.
Wow.
And he tries to avoid the army, but then can't, and basically needs to enlist to survive so that he doesn't get thrown back in jail. And then over the course of the war, what may have been pragmatic or for survival at the start, sort of maybe shifting his politics, by the end of the war seems to have become completely sincere, although he would never say he ended up as a fascist. He ended up as a very sort of conservative poet, and he was with this group of, during the war, other conservative poets like his friend Luis Rosales, who's a fairly famous figure. And so he came out of the war with still kind of hard to track politics, but definitely now on the right. And then over the years, he allowed himself happily to be integrated into the regime as a sort of culture czar, editing poetry magazines, winning prizes given by the regime. So really by the time of his death in the 60s, he's seen as a celebrated Francoist poet and considered fascist, even though he never would have defined himself that way. So it's a very interesting arc. And that was the legacy that his three sons and wife were dealing with, the compromises and the literary weight and political weight of who he was.
I mean, he was kind of like the poet of the regime. I think that's a fair description, right? I mean,
yeah.
It sounds like you've gone away and really dug more and more and more past the documentary. How did you research the book, and how did you decide, you know, what kind of form it should take?
Let's see, in terms of form, I'm a big fan of literary nonfiction that is very well documented, but reads like a novel, or as novelistically as it can be. You know, David Gran, a writer for The New Yorker, I really admire, Eric Larson, these writers who really make true stories feel novelistic. So that was my goal, to do a book like that. And then in terms of the research, yeah, I watched the documentary several times. I ended up publishing an article in this magazine called The Believer in the U.S. And then after doing that, I realized it was still really the tip of the iceberg in terms of the story here. So I spent, before I even realized that I was writing a book or going to write a book, I spent about 2 years just getting more and more obsessed with the family, in a way trying to decode the documentary, because the documentary is, there's this whole matrix of cultural references in the documentary, which it's almost like, if you, unless you read my book, you're not going to understand everything, because there's so many references to historical, cultural events, people. And I remember Jaime, the director of the film, who's become a good friend, after he read my book, he wrote me an email that said something like, thank you, I finally understand my own film. Because there was, which was like the nicest thing anyone could have said. So the way I was able to go so deep into this was, let's see, there was, you know, I went deep into primary sources. So there, Leopoldo Panero, his the father, his archive is in the archive of the Generación de 27 in Malaga. So they have so much material, letters, I mean, just thousands and thousands of pages. And it also has some stuff from Felicidad, his wife. So went deep into the archive. It was incredible reading, you know, love letters from 1940 between Felicidad and Leopoldo, the mother and father, before they get married, finding some of his letters from the war. I have this detail in the book, which is one of my favorite things about, he was there as Franco's troops marched into Barcelona and took it near the end of the war. And he writes his letter, he writes a letter to his mom from Barcelona saying that he needs socks. And so it's just like these weird little moments that are incredible to find in archives. So there was that big archival component. There's a lot of, Felicidad published a memoir, which obviously is very subjective of her experience, but a great story. There's memoirs by other people who talked about the Panetos. Incredible diaries that I found of other people talking about the family. And then with the sons, since they're, even though they're all dead, they're from the generation that was the Javier Marías generation, which were the young hip people in Madrid in the 70s. And then Michi was also a big player in the Movida in the 80s. So a lot of their friends were still alive. So I interviewed close to 100 people. Wow. And got a lot of testimony. Like Javier Marías was a best friend of Michi when they were young men. And so it was just this tapestry of sources, from interviews to other memoirs to letters, old radio recordings that I found in archives, and I just did my best to weave it all together. I guess I really love that, the digging in the archives part of things. And then, because when you land on something, like I found this guy in Madrid who had been kind of a ghostwriter for Michi. They were going to try to write memoirs, and so they wrote about 25 pages together when Michi was in the hospital, and this young writer would go and they'd work on it every day. I checked him down and he incredibly generously gave me the 20 pages, which really no one had seen before. Wow. And that was, you know, that was an incredible source. So those were huge moments when you get those little nuggets.
Mm. I mean, the sons are kind of, they're all poets in their own right. I mean, all writers, they're all involved in the literary world. Three of them, not the best of relationships. Can we go through them a bit?
Yeah.
The oldest is Juan Luis, right?
Yeah, Juan Luis.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah. Well, and just as context, you know, the three of them were brought up by a father who was a poet, a mother who sort of lived to be a muse and almost saw herself as this figure in a 19th century novel. So that's how they grew up. I always say that it was like literature was the family business, and that was both a gift and a burden for them. So Juan Luis, the eldest son, had some of that, maybe that complex of the eldest son of, I must protect the family name and continue our legacy. But he was also, you know, most of his life, he was a drunk and they were all big personalities, and all the three brothers were quite competitive. Juan Luis was a really, I would say, elegant poet, and a lot of people still read him today. He was a transgressive poet, more building on the traditions that came before him.
And he was a bit of, from what I understand, a bit of like a name dropper.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, certainly a name dropper, which, you know, happens a lot in the literary world. I think we use our associations to prop ourselves up a bit. And obviously, they had grown up around all these well-known poets. And yes, that was certainly a part of his identity.
Yeah. The middle child is Leopoldo Maria. You mentioned it to me earlier, the three sons sort of represent archetypal types of writers. Where would Leopoldo Maria fit?
Yeah, I guess if Juan Luis is maybe the more traditional poet who then later in his life almost played the archetype of the recluse, he was living in a small town in El Ampurdam in Catalonia, just writing in obscurity in a way. Leopoldo Maria was the more in the tradition of these transgressive, hard living French poets, like, you know, the poet Maudit. That's all about extreme experience, transgression in behavior and in what you write. So he was, and you know, he did have legitimate mental health struggles, to put it lightly. I think he'd probably be diagnosed as having some sort of schizophrenia. But then also Leopoldo Maria almost used this schizophrenia as a literary device, or almost his life was like a performance piece in some ways. Like, he would go to parties and just behave insanely, probably because he was to a certain degree insane, but also it was that performance of the crazy brilliant poet.
Right.
And his poetry really is wonderful. Roberto Bolaño, one of my favorite writers, the Chilean writer who lived in Catalonia for the last 25 years of his life, you know, talked a lot about how much he admired Leopoldo Maria's poetry, and it really is quite good.
And he went the other way to his older brother and his dad, right? He went to the left. He was, from what I understand.
Yeah. So he in Juan Luis, also the older brother, as a young man, was did rebel politically against his father. He was secretly a member of the Communist Party when it was still legal in Spain, but then ultimately more just like in terms of values, he was more conservative. But yeah, Leopoldo Maria was, he was in, you know, leftist student groups as a young man, protested, thrown in jail, tortured in prison, which was the case for a lot of, youth in the regime who were trying to rebel against their conservative parents who they also saw as complicit in complicit through their complacency.
Michi is the youngest, and you describe in the book as a pyrotechnician. Who is Ichi and why do you describe them as a pyrotechnician?
Right. I would say in the documentary, I think of him as a pyrotechnician because even Jaime, the director, said that in some ways, Michi was like the screenwriter because they would sit down for these family interviews and Michi would kind of set all these little landmines so that arguments would blow up or he would provoke. So it was almost like he was creating all these on screen these sparks, but between the family, really these fires between them. So that was his role in the documentary. And in life, as another archetype, he wanted to reject the family business of literature in some ways because it felt like such a burden. So he fell more into the dilettante playboy architect. Deep down, he did want to be a writer, but I think he also was the weight of it or the expectations were so much too much for him and made him feel vulnerable. But he was a movie critic. He was secretly working on these memoirs. He wanted to be a writer, but it was a lot easier. He was really good looking and charming, and it was much easier to be an alcoholic playboy than the discipline it would have taken to really express his talent.
The one we haven't talked about is Felicidad, their mother. From what I understand, she's kind of a tragic figure, really.
Yeah, I think she is. I mean, you could argue any woman who had to live in the Franco dictatorship, their life was tragic in a way that it wasn't really theirs to live as they would have liked. So that was certainly the case for her. But in other ways, she married Leopoldo, and he charmed her with writing poems about her. She loved the feeling of being amused, but then in her memoir, she talks about, being amused is one thing, but your life isn't what appears in the poems. And she felt completely erased and subjugated in her life as just a Spanish housewife during the Franco dictatorship. And she had literary ambitions of her own. So I do think she is a tragic figure. And then as soon as her husband dies when the kids are still minors, or except for Juan Luis, and so she has to, be the mother of three on her own, and it's very hard. And then Leopoldo Maria, the other Leopoldo in her life, falls into mental illness, and the rest of her life is basically dedicated to taking care of him.
Right.
So. Yeah, and she had a melancholy life, and she was a woman who was sort of drawn also to the romance of being melancholy. Although she was a real secret rebel. I mean, in the documentary of Desencanto, she says some things that she knew would burn all the bridges with her old life and her husband's friends in that community. And then in her memoir, she certainly says things that would have been frowned upon in terms of this idea of not talking badly about the dead or never talking badly about your husband. And then after her husband died, she was also kind of a nightlife character. And
oh, really?
Along with her son in the Madrid nights of the mid to late 60s and 70s, she would be out late. And obviously that was frowned upon too, a woman of her generation doing that. So she's a very seductive figure, and that was when the people who knew her, seductive was the word they used the most about her. I mean, she was considered, one person when she was young called her the prettiest girl in Madrid. She came from this this rich family, and so she had this mystique about her, which I think everyone talked about how elegant and seductive she was really until the end of her life.
I understand that the documentary is kind of like such a cult classic because of the relationship between the three sons, their relationship with the memory of their father, and their mum as well. So can you just expand a bit on their relationship?
Yeah. So what you see in the documentary is a whole these layers of history rising to the surface. The rivalries between the sons to be the literary heir of sorts to the father, the rivalry, almost who can, on the one hand, who can be the mother's favorite and at the same time, who can upset the mother the most?
Wow.
On camera. So, and then you also see how they're each positioning themselves with regard to the legacy of their father. So all of that is playing out in through how they reminisce and retell the family story. So I think of it as a battle for narrative, the narrative of the family, of what is the story of the family. We're going to rewrite that. The Franco years wrote one history of the family. We're going to tear that down, tell our own. And then also the sons fighting to be the main character in the novel of the family. So, and it's just pretty entertaining because they're all a bit, they're a bit ruthless, but also they're so literary. So instead of just bickering like siblings bickering, it's sort of like when they were kids, they would compete to see who recited Lorca the best. And so in an adult version, they're all competing to see who can be the most literary and charismatic and on camera.
Wow. I mean, it does sound like, you know, what we would call a reality show nowadays, right? I mean, I don't want to cheap.
Absolutely. I always say
comparing them to the Kardashians, but
what? I always say they were the Kardashians before the Kardashians. There is something really visionary, well, about the format. I think with Jaime, the director, giving them this space, and then there's something weird, like, about the family that they anticipated the power of this sort of tawdry exhibitionism.
Yeah.
That they understood, and they in a way anticipated, or the phenomenon of it anticipated the voyeurism, which is just ubiquitous. You know, well, it's been ubiquitous for decades now in reality television.
I mean, you get that those observations from the documentary that, you know, they live these literary stereotypes to the extremes. And in the book at the beginning, you compare them to kind of, you know, Don Quixote. Like, you know, he went mad because he consumed so much literature. What did you find when you actually went deeper beyond the documentary for your book? You know, what did you find that about each of them and as a collective family and how they're related to the past and their present, of course?
Yeah. Well, the Quixote, which, if you haven't read El Quixote, I think what stayed in the culture most popularly is this idea of, well, in English, there's the word quixotic, which just means sort of like hopelessly optimistic or have these ideas that can really not be carried off, but you think they can. And so in this idea of tilting of windmills, that's the main idea people get from Quixote. But it, you know, the real story is that this guy, he read too much. He read too many books, and it's like it made him go crazy. Or that's one way you can read it. And he thought he was something that he wasn't. So in that way, I always think the family is just the you know, perfectly Quixotesco, because they kind of read too much. The sons were fed literature from day one, and it made them go a little bit crazy, because it's a classic thing people say about the Panedos, or even the Felicidad said, is they confused life with literature, and they're not the same thing. And that's what I really personally related, because as a person who's always idolized literature and what, you know, wanted to be a part of that tradition, you realize, okay, well, what does that actually mean as a lived thing? We know what literature is in books, and then there's this all this mystique around authors, but what's the life and what's the work? And the family kind of tried to merge those two. And so what, you know, what you see after the documentary is, and which is what I tell in my book, is what comes after in the rest of your life if you've tried to live in this extreme way in which you don't really differentiate between your life and the narrative that you create about your life. And so So you see each of the sons, you know, Juan Luis, they take their archetype to extreme. Juan Luis ends up becoming this sort of reclusive poet. But in a way, he ended up living the most normal life. He had a partner. They lived in a quiet life in Catalonia on the coast, and he kept writing. And then you have Michi, who the playboy, the dilettante, the party kid, the it boy in the movida. He basically drank himself to death, and it's pretty sad, sordid story. But although he does make the very symbolic literary move at the end of his life, is he goes back to his father's ancestral town. The ancestral town of Astorga, where his father was from, where Michi had never lived, and he died there. So again, taking this very symbolic life arc, and then Leopoldo Maria, the brilliant transgressive poet, he spends most of his adult life in psychiatric institutions.
Wow.
And which is again is a sort of mythic literary trope. Of the genius who can't function in the real world and lives his life in an insane asylum. So they both, you know, it's hard to figure it out. They probably wouldn't have lived the same lives if they hadn't been brought up in this very literary milieu, which I think is fascinating.
I mean, the relationships, you know, trying to outdo each other to get the mother's favor. I mean, Freud would have a field day with you.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I mean, also, I mean, we interviewed the son of one of the international brigaders, Jack Jones, and he was kind of saying, you know, there's this narrative that the Spanish Civil War was the poet's war because a couple of poets went join the international brigade. But, you know, he said the lived reality was the majority of them were working class factory workers,
right.
You know.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the difference between, you know, the narrative and the reality, I suppose.
I will say I totally agree that there is this layer of romance that's been built around that, and it's a very good point. At the same time, something I don't think you see today when people are going to war, or maybe I'm mistaken, but you know, Miguel Hernandez would be reading his poetry to groups of soldiers before they would go out to fight. There was literary magazines in both the Franco nationalist forces and the Republican forces. There was literary magazines being circulated with poetry. It's like, that's not something, it's kind of hard to imagine today, like American soldiers going when they went to Iraq, and then their superior saying, okay, here's the issue of our poetry magazine to get you all hyped up to fight. You know, it's hard to imagine. Although of course in reality it was just the horror and grit of war then as it is now, but there was this literary quality to it that I can understand that idea of the poet's war.
So with regards to narrative and you know, the kind of this distinction, why do you think the Paneros are good? Because they do make really good subject for exploring the Spanish Civil War, but also really exploring a side of the war that, you know, can't really be told in facts and figures and battle maneuvers and you know, these kind of things. You know, for you writing this book, what's it been like, and what sort of reactions have you had to the book with regards to this sort of topic?
Well, so yeah, I mean, what drew me to the Paneros is that they're the life of the family really traces the whole 20th century in Spanish history. The father, Leopoldo, was born in 1909, and the last son, Leopoldo Maria, died in 2014. So it was this really perfect century-long arc during what, you know, a very eventful century for Spain. So on the one hand, following them was a wonderful opportunity to just tell the story of Spain beyond just the war, but into the experience of the dictatorship, the transition, the destape and the movida in that period, and then all the way into the economic boom. And then the crisis, it just sort of, for me, they were just a great doorway into discussing all of that. Also, you can read the family itself as a metaphor. And I tried not to do that too much, but it's also just inevitable to say they, you know, this family represented, you know, all these things in 20th century Spain, which can be a bit of a a literary projection in itself, almost something like the Pinedos would do. So you can read them as a metaphor, as people have, or you can read them as just like, by telling their story, you get to also tell a lot of, you know, eventful things about Spain. Not exactly that they weren't exactly the Forrest Gumps of Spain, but in that sense of like Forrest Gump, that story, you know, he's a character who gives you a way into a lot of important events. Something similar happens. And, you know, I think that was some, so I've had different the U.S. reaction to my book is very different from the Spanish reaction. You know, it was published in the U.S., not published in Spain, probably in part because Spaniards have some misgivings about my book. For American readers, I think it's just, who is this wild family? This is crazy. I've never heard this before. This is interesting. The general reaction, which is fairly, you know, clearly divided, is people either love the family or hate them. Some people say they're crazy and obnoxious, but I love spending time with them. Other people say they're such horrible people. How did you spend years researching them? So that's often the reaction I get from English language readers. From Spanish readers, because although it hasn't been published in Spanish, it was reviewed in El País with the guy wasn't crazy about it, although he had some complimentary words about the writing. And one of the things that he said, I'm blanking on his name, was Shulman, you know, buys into all the myths and sees this family as a metaphor. They weren't a metaphor. They were just a weird, dysfunctional family. That's it. And I can see where that critic was coming from. And I mean, and I think, you know, for people who knew the family, I think they just thought they were just dysfunctional people. And it was, in some people who read the book who knew the family, it was a question of like, how well did I represent who these people really were? And then for younger readers, I think there's always new generations who are watching El Desencanto, of kind of, you know, people who are into those sort of old cult films, and younger readers who discover it and kind of want to geek out like I did about the Pinedo family. And then I've gotten, I would say, from Spanish readers, the nicest reactions I've gotten, they're often actually from Spanish academics who live in the U.S., who, so obviously they're Spanish, but have maybe a slightly different cultural distance that maybe similar to my perspective. And those are always the nicest emails I tend to get, is from, and not just Spaniards who live in the U.S., but there's been quite a few who've reached out to me.
And just out of curiosity, I mean, what was it like writing a book about, you know, a family that were so, you know, so close to the regime? I mean, you know, a lot of books that do come out, especially in English, and maybe I'm just saying this because it's what comes up on my algorithms on different book websites and things, but normally it's about, you know, like war heroes on the left, you know, Passionaria, the Intash Brigades, you know, all of these things. And then on the other side of it, you have some of the more serious autobiographies, you know, Paul Preston has written one about Franco and Juan Carlos, and this kind of thing. And then you have the more general, you know, Spanish Civil War books. So what was it like writing a book about someone that identified and was a hero of the Franco dictatorship, but also kind of, you know, he's not Franco and he's not Juan Carlos?
I mean, I like the challenge of it in that I had to try to understand how Leopoldo, the father, went from being a communist before the Spanish Civil War to then completely collaborating, being, you know, happily co-opted by the regime after the war. So that was a real sort of fact digging and psychological challenge for me to try to unravel that. Not that I ever fully did, but it was a lot to think about. And then it was very interesting to really humanize him and right. Say like, God, this guy was just, you know, I mean, he didn't kill anyone. He wasn't an executioner, but so I wasn't humanizing a murderer, but I was humanizing someone who had, you know, been a part of a horrible, murderous regime. And so that was an interesting experience. And I actually found it enriching to try to figure out, okay, like who was this as a human being? And I think also, I think in Spain, there's some discomfort with that, especially on the left, the idea of giving this person due thought. And as for me as an outsider, not as a Spaniard, it was less complicated for me to do that. But I also in a way I wanted, obviously I'm more politically aligned with the left and the Republic, but when I tell the story of the Spanish Civil War in the book, I'm also critical of the Republic because they made lots of mistakes, and I think it's important to be honest about that. And I think there's in Spain, I think there is a bit more discomfort that they want these stories because of all the pain and trauma that's really still present today. They want things to be a bit more black and white. And for me, it was
black and white, right?
Exactly. And for me, it was really interesting digging into the nuances.
And how did your friends react? That you were going to write this book.
I think my friends were just like, Aaron's always gets obsessed with some weird thing and goes down a rabbit hole, and this is what it is now. But I think it made sense. I mean, I finally started on the book after we had left Spain and we were living in LA, and so in a way, it was a period I was really missing Spain. My wife and I left largely because of the global economic crisis. And it was a sad, I mean, we ended up spending 10 years in California and those were great years, but there was a lot of sadness because my wife really felt kind of exiled, economically or in terms of opportunity from Spain. So it was, I think it was nostalgia for me, a nice way of reliving. And I would go back to Spain for weeks at a time to go to archives and do interviews. So I think that was probably how people understood part of what I was doing. And then, I'm into literary things, and this was an opportunity for me to go really deep into some people who are way more literary than I was.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the time, Aaron.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking about all this.